Israel launches an operation at the Shifa Hospital in Gaza.
We know that senior Hamas terrorists have regrouped inside the Shifa Hospital.
The European Union's top diplomat accused Israel of using starvation as a weapon.
And it's not a question of a lack of sufficient supplies.
Russia's Vladimir Putin wins a fifth term as president in an election observers call not free or fair.
Probably in his mind critical to his authority, his legitimacy, to show this overwhelming turnout and overwhelming support. Even though many, if not most, know exactly how it's manufactured.
Plus an update on the violence in Haiti. Today is Monday, March 18th, and this is VOA's Flashpoint Global Crises. Hello, I'm Steve Miller, in for Steve Karish. Several explosions were seen over the Gaza Strip on Monday morning as Israeli forces launched another raid on the Shifa Hospital in Gaza City, accusing Hamas of using it as a base. In a video statement, Israel Defense Forces spokesperson Rear Admiral Daniel Hagari calls it a high-precision operation.
We know that senior Hamas terrorists have regrouped inside the Shifa Hospital and are using it to command attacks against Israel.
He said that the IDF was conducting the operation with caution and care while ensuring that the hospital continues its important functions, adding that they would also be conducting a humanitarian effort to provide food, water, and other supplies to the patients and civilians in the hospital compound.
There is no obligation for the patients and the medical staff to evacuate the hospital, but there is and will be a passageway for other civilians to exit the hospital.
Gaza's health ministry says around 30,000 people are sheltering at the hospital, including patients, medical staff, and people who have fled their homes seeking safety. The army last raided Shifa Hospital in November, claiming Hamas maintained an elaborate command center within and beneath the facility. The military revealed a tunnel leading to a bunker as well as weapons within it, saying it was found inside the hospital, but evidence fell short of the earlier claims, and critics accused the army of recklessly endangering the lives of civilians. In a separate development, the European Union's top diplomat, Josep Borrell, accused Israel of continuing to hinder efforts to deliver aid to Gaza, saying the territory faces an entirely man-made famine.
It is unacceptable. Starvation is used as a weapon of war. Yes. Starvation is used as a weapon of war. Let's say that. And it's not a question of a lack of sufficient supplies. We hear that there are several months of food stocked on the Egyptian side.
Borrell urged the Israeli authorities and the country's prime minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, to stop hindering the aid effort. The Gaza Health Ministry said on Monday that at least 31,726 Palestinians have been killed thus far in the war, including 81 during the past 24 hours. The ministry doesn't differentiate between civilians and combatants in its count, but says women and children make up two-thirds of the dead. Airdrops by the United States and other nations continue, while deliveries on a new sea route have begun, but aid groups say it's essential that Israel open up more ground routes and ease restrictions to meet the mounting humanitarian needs. Israeli authorities say that they place no limits on the entry of aid and accuse UN bodies of failing to distribute it in a timely manner, saying aid piles up on the Gaza side of the crossings. Speaking at the United Nations, Secretary General Antonio Guterres echoed the alarm by the UN Food Agency, in which it says famine is imminent in northern Gaza, where 70% of the remaining population is experiencing catastrophic hunger. It says a further escalation of the war could push around half of Gaza's total population to the brink of starvation.
The latest report on food insecurity in Gaza is an appalling indictment of conditions on the ground for civilians. The world's leading experts on food insecurity clearly document that famine in the northern part of Gaza is imminent. More than half of all Palestinians in Gaza, 1.1 million people, have completely exhausted their food supplies and are facing catastrophic hunger, according to the report. Palestinians in Gaza are enduring horrifying levels of hunger and suffering. This is the highest number of people facing catastrophic hunger ever recorded by the Integrated Food Security Classification System anywhere, anytime.
Meanwhile, Israeli officials say that they will send a high-level delegation headed by its Mossad chief to Qatar on Monday for mediated talks with Hamas. Earlier, I spoke with Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem to get the latest on these developments.
So as opposed to previous Israeli incursions into Shifa Hospital, this time Israel seems very, careful that they want to show that, A, they're being careful not to harm patients and doctors in the hospital, and B, that Hamas actually was using the hospital. They released footage of Hamas shooting at Israeli troops in the hospital. They said this senior Hamas official who they say was involved in planning what happened on October 7th, the massacre of, 1,300 Israelis was killed, and about 80 people were arrested. They showed an Israeli soldier was also killed in that fighting. And in addition, the defense ministry, they actually called the hospital officials and coordinated with them and said that people in the hospital did not have to evacuate, but they did suggest that civilians who were near the hospital should evacuate. So, in 5.5 months of fighting, it seems that Israel has learned some lessons. At the same time, the Shifa Hospital was supposed to be one of the areas that was under Israeli control. And the fact that Hamas was able to get back in and have people inside Shifa Hospital, the fact that they had to go back to Shifa Hospital raises a question. Goals are and how they've, the military goals and how they've been achieved.
Linda, what about the humanitarian situation? On Monday, we heard very stark descriptions of the situation in Gaza from not only UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, but also EU Foreign Policy Chief Joseph Borrell. And while Israel is pushing back against some of the notions that they are responsible for the delays of aid getting in there, what can you share with us about what's happening on the ground?
Right. Well, so I think that the aid situation will be solved in the next few weeks. There's this ship that came from Cyprus, but it seems that the situation is quite bad. People in Gaza talk about really having nothing to eat. They've seen children malnourished. People spend basically their entire day trying to find a little bit of food. And the UN has said that a quarter of the residents in Gaza are on the verge of famine and starvation. So it seems that, the situation has gotten quite desperate. There is even talk that people are eating animal feed, that one of the few things left. Now, the question is, Israel said that it's willing to allow as much aid as anyone wants into Gaza, as long as it can be inspected first to make sure that there isn't anything that Hamas could use. Israel also says that Hamas is stealing a lot of the aid before it even gets there, and says that the problem is with distribution. The Palestinians say that Israel is simply not letting enough aid in. In a sort of fairly sharp rebuke to UNRWA, the UN Relief and Works Agency, which is the UN agency that deals with the Palestinians, which Israel has been very angry at. It says that some of the staffers of UNRWA are members of Hamas, and Israel today did not allow the Secretary General of UNRWA, Philippe Lazzarini, into Rafah. He was supposed to go and visit, and he was not allowed in.
And Linda, one last question. There is an additional round of ceasefire talks expected to begin on Monday. What can you tell us about the prospects and what may happen?
So the talks are supposed to start this evening in Doha, although nobody is expecting a breakthrough in the next day or two. They said it's a question of weeks, if anything. At least the Israeli press reports are saying that Hamas has softened its position somewhat. It is no longer insisting on a total Israeli withdrawal from Gaza or a total ceasefire, and it's willing to do things in stages. Israel, look, has the hostage issue is a huge issue in Israel. You know, the reporting, it's constant on the TV and radio, and you hear from the parents of hostages and the sisters of hostages. And, you know, Israel's a very small country, and everybody knows somebody who is a hostage. I actually have a friend of mine's son, Hirsch Goldberg Polan, is a hostage. So it's very much present in people's minds. And, you know, Israel very much wants to get them out. There are 134 hostages, but at least 35 of them are not alive anymore. So the question is, how many are alive? And in this first stage, it would be the release of women, children, wounded people, and old people. You know, yesterday there was a big campaign in Israel. The oldest hostage, who's still believed to be alive, is 86 years old, and he apparently is a big fan of ice cream. So they said to celebrate his birthday, which was yesterday, everybody should eat ice cream. There is a recipe book being published going around now of the favorite recipes of the hostages. So I think it's something that's a huge deal for Israelis, and they're willing to pay a very big price, which would mean a 6-week ceasefire, hundreds of Palestinian prisoners being released, including some who are responsible for murdering Israelis, and huge amounts of aid going into Gaza. Now, Hamas also needs a break from the fighting, and Hamas also needs that humanitarian aid going in, because they're concerned that if the starvation gets worse, if people really are starving to death, that public opinion could turn against Hamas, and they could say, you know, what has Hamas gotten us into? So there is an interest on all sides for this to happen, but there apparently the sides are still pretty far apart.
Linda Gradstein reports for VOA from Jerusalem. Linda, thank you.
Sure. My pleasure, Steve. Take care.
U.S. President Joe Biden also spoke with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on Monday, but a full readout of the call was not released by our recording deadline, and we'll have that update on our website. Still to come, a warning to all about elections.
Citizens and candidates will face a flood of falsehoods that suffocate serious civic debate.
This is VOA News. You're listening to Flashpoint Global Crises from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Miller. The Kremlin said on Monday that President Vladimir Putin's re-election showed that the Russian people were consolidated around him. Kremlin spokesperson Dmitry Peskov added that Moscow was not interested in Washington's criticism, saying that the United States was in a de facto war with Russia in Ukraine. The comment appears to be in response to the White House saying that the Russian elections were obviously not free nor fair, as Putin had imprisoned his opponents and prevented others from running against him. While not surprised by Putin's predictable win, most people in the streets of Kyiv say that they expected that the Russian president would escalate attacks on Ukraine. This resident says that the re-election of President Putin meant that things were likely to get much worse in Ukraine, with possible escalation of attacks and attempts to capture more territory. VOA Scott Walterman talked about why Putin held the election with Professor Robert English, an expert on the politics of Russia and the former USSR, and the Cold War director of the University of Southern California School of International Relations.
Why is it important for Putin to put on this show, for his own people or for the world?
It's for both, and also for himself, for a third party. I think, let's start with that. He simply has a large ego. But like many dictators, he simultaneously has this megalomania combined with insecurity. And so, as we've seen with so many others, just the ritual, the performance, the ceremony seems very important to him. And so he orchestrates it very elaborately. As for his own people, yes, it's probably in his mind critical to his authority, his legitimacy, to show this overwhelming turnout and overwhelming support, even though many, if not most, know exactly how it's manufactured. Finally, I think both of those contribute to his perceived need for projecting strength abroad.
This is already nothing like the Russia, the Soviet Union of the past. There's no Politburo anymore. It's really a one-man decision-making apparatus. Where does he go from here? Where do you think he already pretty tightly controls everything, doesn't he?
Pretty tightly. It's a curious hybrid. You're right in that it's not a collective leadership the way the Politburo was at most turns in the Soviet period. It wasn't always, of course, but yes, he is a dictator.
In the near term, do you think that he'll move to consolidate even more? Because I saw the protest votes taking place in European capitals particularly, but even inside the country where there were individual acts of vandalism at the polling places, I don't think I've ever seen that before.
No, that was really significant in my estimation, especially that inside the country. And let's remember, probably thousands, maybe tens of thousands in total participated in this so-called noon against Putin, this kind of noontime flash mob where everybody came at the same hour to vote, which is, of course, their civic duty, but did it in such a way at such a time that it meant I'm against Putin. That's something significant. It has to infuriate him. And let's not forget how hard he tried and his staff tried to prevent that. They spent, as we know from the documents that have leaked now, approximately $1 billion, right, to whip up patriotic fervor with pro-Putin, pro-war propaganda to get the result he did. And on top of that, in these last weeks, they put out some considerable effort with hacking, with false messages, with they used all their sort of cyber tricks. And still, tens of thousands came. So some might say that was a small number, and certainly they weren't armed and in rebellion. But the best they could do to suppress that, and tens of thousands still came out. So I see that as a crack in his armor, not as a sign of strength, but of impending weakness.
And that's the Cold War director of the University of Southern California's School of International Relations, Robert English, speaking with my colleague, Scott Walterman. Seven bodies were found in Paytonville, Haiti, located just outside the capital of Port-au-Prince. That's coming from a Reuters source who was at the site, confirming earlier media reports. Unfortunately, further details have not been immediately available. Gang violence has spiraled in Haiti, fueling a humanitarian crisis, cutting off food supplies and forcing hundreds of thousands from their homes. The UN Children Agency said on Saturday that one of its aid containers at Haiti's main port was stocked with essential items for maternal, neonatal, and child survival was looted as gangs increasingly control the capital. Now, to learn more about what's happening on the ground, I spoke with Jacquele Belizaire in VOA's Creole service.
The gangs continue to spread the terror. They vandalize many private homes belong to the private sector, belong to the richest people. The situation is getting worse and worse because the gang members control almost the capital. We talk about last week, they vandalize and burn the house of the police national chief. So the situation is getting worse with the gang that they control the capital.
Jacquele, what about the multinational security force that Kenya was supposed to lead? I mean, it was supposed to go in and then it was essentially paused. So What can you share with our listeners about the latest development on that front?
Yeah, the latest news about the force, Kenya, because now we are in a chaotic situation, and Kenya say he has to wait until we have a government or we have a normal situation, because you know the international community and the Caribbean community, the CARICOM, they are trying to have a presidential college to manage the transition. So in the meantime, Kenya say he has to wait. The reason why he put a pause about the project. So they are waiting for maybe a new government in Haiti.
Is that a realistic expectation? Because as I understand it, one of the reasons for this multinational force is to provide support to the police and the military, who aren't as well positioned to handle the security situation there.
You know, there are a lot of questions about this situation. We don't know how long it will take to have the government, and you know, the gangs are powerful, and they even demonstrate their force, their power. So there are a lot of question marks about this situation, so we don't know.
And one last question before you have to go. What about the aid situation there? Because we are reading and hearing about the underlying humanitarian crisis that's unfolding in Haiti.
This situation is getting worse in terms of a humanitarian aspect, because, you know, they have a shortage of water, a shortage of food, and all the basic stuff that we need. The situation is getting worse. They are talking about a humanitarian bridge between Dominican Republic and Haiti. But I overheard that somebody or an official from the Dominican Republic say there is no way they will accept to have a bridge, a humanitarian bridge from Dominican Republic to Haiti. So the international community can provide a humanitarian assistance, but there is a question mark about this project as well.
Jacques Bellezaire reports for VOA's Creole service. Jacques, thank you very much for your reporting.
Oh, thank you for having me. Thank you so much.
A fact-finding mission mandated by the United Nations said on Monday that the death of Mahsa Amini in custody of Iran's morality police was unlawful and caused by violence, and that women in the country remain subjected to wide-ranging discrimination. The death of the 22-year-old Amini, a Kurdish-Iranian woman, in September of 2022, while in custody for allegedly violating the Islamic dress code, unleashed months of mass protests across Iran. Her death marked the biggest challenge to Iran's clerical leaders in decades. And finally, North Korea fired short-range ballistic missiles into the sea on Monday for the first time in 2 months. The launch came as U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken visited Seoul for a conference hosted by President Yoon Suk-yeol on advancing democracy. There, Blinken warned that
citizens and candidates will face a flood of falsehoods that suffocate serious civic debate.
Blinken repeated Washington's accusations that Russia and China are behind global campaigns aimed at manipulating information. Some European officials have also accused Russia of conducting disinformation campaigns using AI.
Countering misleading information is essential, but it's not sufficient. Just as we tackle falsehoods and distortions in the immediate term, we have to invest in making ourselves more resilient to them in the long term.
Digital threats to democracy and how technology can promote democracy and universal human rights are expected to be the main agenda of the 3-day meetings attended by representatives by more than 30 countries. And that's going to do it for today's program. But of course, there's more coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and as well on our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone at VOA, we thank you for listening. And until next time, I'm Steve Miller. For deeper dives and expert analysis, listen to VOA Podcasts. Issues in the News explores the biggest stories every weekend, while International Edition keeps you informed every weekday. Plus, with a 5-minute newscast at the top of every hour, you're always up to date.